יהיה תרגום מאנגלית לעברית אחורה. So you can hear me, it's okay. שומעים אותי? בסדר. So the title of the talk is How to Be Empty, Yet Make a Difference. How to be empty, yet make a difference. Indeed, there's many challenges and questions about the issue of equanimity, and also some resistance. And this is fine. And we've had them in the groups, and you may be feeling these questions, and certainly I have and had these questions all the time. And I'll just throw out some of the questions which are quite challenging that I want to address this evening. First question is, equanimity comes from the word equal. Shavé. But I don't want to be equal. I need my preferences, adifuyot. I need things not to be equal. It feels a bit flat to be equal. I need preferences, choices. So how does that work? Indeed, how do I choose what is better if equanimity is undoing all the preferences and interests that this should be like that, this is better for me like that, and I want to go there and not there? How do we choose from the basis of equanimity? Everything like this. How do I choose in life? How do I decide? How do I find my journey in life if everything is like that? Another question which comes up is very basic to the Dharma. Very nice to hear the story of the empty boat, being like the empty boat that nobody can shout at, because we're empty. But it's really scary. I need a ground. I need a ground. Emptiness sounds scary. It's interesting, in brackets, so Grime, I want to say that 2 weeks ago, I was part of a conference of scientists, researchers, kind of real major professors in brain science from Israel and from abroad. It was in Neve Shalom. It was a small gathering. Philosophers, Buddhists, scientists, researchers, psychologists are looking at consciousness. And my role was, you could say, bilbulei moach. If we're talking about consciousness, I just made a mess, as the Buddhists must really ought to do. But it's interesting because one of the things that came up there in discussion was whenever we look at something called consciousness, one of the places we get to is no ground, is groundlessness. And there are texts, scientific texts, written about the experience of groundlessness when we try and define what is consciousness. We end up in empty space. So it's interesting that even the scientists researchers could understand that we're in a place like Joseph's beautiful image, that the Dharma is like jumping out of a plane without a parachute. It's really scary until you realize there's no ground. It doesn't matter anymore. You're just flying. So, more questions. If I trust, if there is trust, how can I make change in the world? And a very obvious question, if I'm very equanimous, putting up with everything, trusting everything, do I go to the doctor? How do I act? So I want to relate to some of these questions right now. The first thing is, in the practice of seeing, of awareness, we come to understand, we come to a place of wisdom. We begin to see things more deeply. Dharma is seeing things as they really are, instead of being lost in illusion, in dream, in maya. And so when we talk about equanimity or equal, things being equal, indeed, by seeing things more deeply, gradually our preferences, our dufuyot shelanu, get less intense, get less serious. They're not holy anymore, kadosh. We can't actually, things can not be equal in themselves, ever. There will always be asymmetry. Things cannot be equal because there is simply diversity, the givun in life. So if we try and make things equal, they cannot be. There's this very nice Monty Python little skit that I saw way back, where Monty Python was acting as a Robin Hood in the forest. Shoded Yar Drachim. So there was a carriage that came full of people. He stopped the carriage with his gun and said, "Get out, give me all your jewels, give me everything." So someone said to him, "Well, why do you do this?" And he said, "I'm taking from the rich to give to the poor." So they all thought about it, the passengers on this carriage. And then one said to, "Yes, but I'm rather poor." And so Monty Python, or Robin Hood, said, "Oh, okay, I'll give you one from this guy. I'll give you one of his jewels." And then the other one said, "Well, I'm half poor." So, okay, I'll take from here and give to there. And in the end, all of them were in a total mess, trying to make everything equal, and they couldn't. So things can't be equal ontologically in the reality. But as we begin to look deeply at our experience, our relationship becomes wiser, and we begin to see that our experiences are all equal in not being absolutely true. They're equally illusion. Do we really know what is a tree? We learned from a child what is a tree. Do we really know what it is? Do we really know who you are, who I am? Do we really know what things in themselves really are? Nobody can tell us. The philosophers cannot. The Ding an sich, the reality, nobody can really tell us what reality is. So we're in a world of illusion and unreliable reality. And slowly, slowly, from that basis, we begin to see things differently. And we begin, for example, to see that everything comes from conditions. Because of conditions that arise, our experience arises. A tree is a bunch of conditions which we are used to calling a tree. We have an agreement called, that's a tree. Dogs have another agreement. It's just a place to do pee-pee. So if we look at things more deeply, we see that things are indeed in a certain way equal. They're equally untrue or equally unreliable, and the truth tends to be equally more deeply true. And somehow or other, every experience that we have is equal in the sense of being a source of awakening for us, a source of looking for the truth or meeting the truth. Every experience through the senses has a certain sameness about it, which is, here is something to discover, here is something that is a message, here is an invitation. On a big level, where is our point of view or point of reference? Nukuda hityachasut. If our point of reference is shoni, difference, I want this and this is good, this is nice, this is not nice, this is that, this is this, I have a preference here. That's a point of view of the self. But what about the point of view of the Buddha mind? What will that, how will that look at things? And there is there much more sense of things being open, the same, universal, insof, endless, big, the big picture has far less preference in it, adifuyot. The big picture is the big picture. Oneness. Okay, it's a new age language. Oneness. But oneness is about, is not preferences. Oneness is oneness. I remember, I've got a video of this. 30 years ago, I was wandering in the Himal Pradesh in Kulu Valley, with my three daughters at the time, and Rachel. And we came to a kind of a castle in near Kulu Valley, Manali, in the mountains. And there was a kind of guru there who didn't stop talking about oneness. And my daughter had this on film, it was videoed, it was very nice. My daughter, at the age of 11, said to him, Swami, see this table? Are you telling me that the nail is the same as the wood? I see two things, a nail and a piece of wood. Are you telling me they're the same? And the Swami actually couldn't really answer her. What do you say to an 11-year-old sharp little girl? But the Dharma invites us to a bigger picture, and a bigger picture is less interested in preference. I want them like this, I want things like that, they should be better like this, they have to be like that. The big picture is much less making us a puppet to our desires and needs and preferences. We become less of a puppet. And things do feel more equal, yes. But equanimity is very precious. We become less of a puppet, a buba al-hutim, to every need, preference, desire, wish that we want. Bali, zeh, bali, 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 lo bali, lo bali, lo bali. And so the preference lead us into a rather restricted place of being a puppet to our choices and needs. So then things happen in life, but without preferences, there's far less drama. Yes, we can laugh and we can cry. Of course we can laugh and of course we can cry. Nobody's wanting us to be machines. And actually, in a way, I think many people who've been in the Dharma for some time, including myself, will say, I laugh and cry much more easily now than ever before. Because it just comes as flow from the heart. But no dramas. One of the best descriptions of equanimity, I think, is no drama. In two words. So another aspect, which I think is general in the Dharma, altogether in the Dharma, is there is a conflict, apparently a conflict, because the Dharma does seem to be going into a place of non-action, of stillness, of, equanimity, like quiet. And so there's a question, what about functioning? Tifkud. Don't I need my preferences to function in the world? Don't I need to be fired by desire? How do I get up in the morning? How do I catch a train without desire to catch a train? So do I go to a doctor? Or is that not equanimous? I shouldn't go to a doctor because it's not equanimous. Well, the Buddha had a doctor. Actually, why not? And I'm sure the Buddha felt hunger, and off he went to the village every day to collect the food. And of course we function. There's nothing wrong with thought. Without thought, we couldn't do anything. I couldn't speak to you now if there was a problem with thought. So thought is no problem, it's just functioning of the mind. We function to keep our life going. We do what's needed in order to live. That's not against equanimity. Equanimity is a deep sense of no drama, if you like, or of steadiness. But in that place we function. We do what's needed. And actually it's even easier without dramas. It's actually easier to function if there's less drama around everything that we do. And sometimes actually the functioning can show us our equanimity in a strange way. It's a personal story. When I was just last year in the States, and I was teaching in a lot of places, and I arranged a totally crazy schedule for myself, which was 18 events, evenings or day-longs, all through California, Washington, New York, Boston, and mostly in California, Spirit Rock and other places. Almost every day another Dharma center, and in between driving strange roads with a hired car, and I was sick all the time. Somehow it just happened I was sick, so I come home every evening with a fever, in Chom, every day. And I was watching, well, this is hard going. And don't worry, I'm not going to do it again so quickly. You won't lose me like that. It's hard going. And then I began to notice that because of the difficulty, my sense of equanimity was actually stronger. Because I went into a mode where I needed to feel that functioning was looking after itself. That I didn't need to be the one to be in the drama of function, of tifgud. I had to feel that everything is happening by itself. Driving was happening by itself, finding the route, doing the telephone calls, arranging this, sorting out what I needed to talk about, meeting the people, etc., planning the whole thing, going back, da-da-da-da. It had to be just function. And so it actually made me more equanimous in a way, and really sense that the only way I could do this whole thing was to sense functioning is happening, it doesn't need me. Equanimity is really valuable and precious, and I can be equanimous, and then functioning is just going to happen by itself. So the difficulty actually helped me to in a way, function better, as long as I had equanimity. So I know it sounds strange to say, how can I function as if things happen by themselves? Because it's me doing things. But wait a minute. If we really look carefully, things happen because of conditions. Because there's a car driving this way and then driving is happening. Because of many, many, many conditions, driving is happening. You could say, am I in charge of all of this? It's a question. You can say, and you can feel in charge, or you cannot feel in charge and just feel driving is happening. I talk a bit about it with the staff here in service retreat. Can we cook as if just cooking is happening? Doesn't need me, the cook. I have to not burn the rice. Yes, burn the rice, not burn the rice. So much better if we just step back and get a sense that the cooking is happening because that's the right thing right now. And that's what's needed and it's just happening. Taking away the pressure and the control and the ownership, ba'alut, of action. So it feels different. It's not about switching off. It's the heart is right there. But action and function feels more like the Tao, like the Tao. If any of you read Tao Te Ching, every poem in the Tao is saying exactly what I'm saying now, but just a lot more poetic and lovely. But it's no different. The Tao is happening by itself. The wind comes and blows. Be like the grass that the wind is blowing. Practice Aikido. practice moving according to the wind and the causes and conditions, flow with the causes and conditions. That's not me standing there fighting causes and conditions according to my needs and preferences and so on. Just, you know, how different it would be when we have an argument with somebody. Dispute, vikuach. How much that could change with another view. The person is saying things because of his conditioning and his condition or her conditions and her situation. And maybe this person got up on the wrong side in the morning. And maybe this person is frustrated because he had a hard childhood. And maybe, okay, conditions create something. And your conditions create something. And on that place, you don't need to fight this person. Maybe there's other ways of relating. Maybe there's another way from a sense of conditions create actions, and I'm with that. And for that wisdom, including no preference, I don't have to defend myself so much, the empty boat, the whole conversation can take another journey. You can find another way instead of the conflict. Equanimity is a power. In a way, it is an action, but a power of steadiness. It is not passive. It is not stepping out. It's being right in the middle of things and bringing steadiness and openness and inner freedom right in the heart of things. It's been many times in a lot of peace work that I've been doing for years, right in the middle of really difficult situations between Palestinians and Israelis, in weekends or in dialogues or in groups, where the only thing that works is equanimity. And then you have to be a model and just be equanimous, just sit in your place and radiate, mishader, radiate steadiness. And if you do that, other people can be steady as well, because you're giving a model of, everyone needs it. People don't like to be all over the place in the hysteria and drama. It's painful to be in dramas. So in a way, people are looking for somebody to help to cool down the fires. So you can be active as, your equanimity is a power. The Buddha once, in one text, someone asked the Buddha, how do you talk to somebody that's arguing with you? Vikuach. And the Buddha said, well, if the person hasn't got strong emotions at that time, and if the person hasn't got very strong views at that time, then it's quite easy. You can have a dialogue. If they've got strong views but not strong emotions, it's not so easy, it's quite tiring, but possible. Or if they have strong emotions, but they don't have strong views, not so easy, but it's possible. But if they have both strong views and strong emotions, forget it. However, the bottom line of this piece, this sutta, it's a very ancient sutta, the bottom line is, don't try and argue, but never forget the power of equanimity. That's the sentence at the end of this text. And I think about it a lot when I'm meeting people in my travels around, especially in Israel, that start, you know the story. Sometimes the best thing to do is radiate equanimity, which can be in language. You can actually say some words to help steadiness, to help steady, to help cool the fires. So being an equanimous is a bit like being a lightning conductor sometimes. Colette Barak. You just kind of can earth the energy before it gets exploded. And in a way, to some extent, this is a role of Ron and myself in this retreat and teachers in retreats, to be a bit of a lightning conductor, Colette Barak, because retreat can be a bit hairy and crazy, and people can go in the silence into crazy places, and it happens, and everything gets blown up into balloons, you know. And it's really sometimes all I need to do as a teacher is to sit here steady and say, it'll be okay. just to give a model of steadiness. That's maybe half the teaching is done. So maybe I'll shut up. So a very big question that comes up all the time is, if I go for trust, if I have to accept things as they are, and I go for equanimity, how do I make change? Where do I take the motive to change the world or change myself? Or if everything is okay as it is, then do I need to do anything? So I think it needs an understanding of what is trust. And trust is not the expectation that things will be better, because that's expectations, not trust. And if things don't get better, if we say trust is, I trust that things will be all right. So everybody says that. I trust that things will be okay in the end. It's okay to say that, it's a feel that, it's all right. But it needs a deeper understanding, because if they don't get better, so what happens to our trust? And this is really a big story. So many, many people really live a life of disappointment and frustration because they grow up as a child with so much trust that things will be good, and then they get all the makot of life, and so the trust is destroyed. And it really is a major, major issue for so many people growing up with being quite depressed because they had maybe trust and life wasn't better for them. So it's really important. It's not a small thing. So we have to understand what is trust. Trust is not trust that things will be better. Trust is an atmosphere in us. Is an attitude, gisha, inner attitude, not about what will happen or what we want to happen, but it's an inner attitude of saying, allowing things to be the way they are. Near. Allowing things to be the way they are right now. Instead of our attachments to what we want, to what we think they should be, to what we want to control life, we want things to be different, we want to be in control. And from that comes all the struggle and the anger and so on and the frustration and so trust is an inner attitude saying things are the way they are. I'm allowing them to be like that. It's a little different from, it's not exactly Kabbalah acceptance, because there's something a bit, in acceptance, is like, I have to accept. and it's a little bit more pressure. But trust is like a kind of a, there's an English image of pouring oil on stormy water, and then it makes the water like this. To pour oil on stormy seas, then the sea gets quieter. That's trust. And I mean, think of so many places where if we really want to make change with an attitude of control or anger or way we think things should be, we just make so much pressure. And instead of that, we can say, from trust, my attitude is to heal. An attitude of healing, not an attitude of, I want to change everything. I want to get things better. I want things not to be like that. I want them to be like that. So healing itself is something different. It's in a way, like if we're sick, we want to spread in our body encouragement to the body to heal itself. We may take a medicine, but we also want to tell the body, I trust you, I support you, I'm there with you, and then attitude is healing, instead of fighting the problem or controlling everything. So, I mean, one of the examples that came up in this retreat was someone that said, you know, how do I deal with people close to me that eat meat when I really feel pain in my heart for the animals? And one of the places we discussed, we talked about, is just compassion. And compassion is coming from a big view. You have compassion for the person eating meat, as well as for the animals that suffer. Compassion is from the big picture. It's not about, I must change this, and this is bad, and this is good, and I have to fix that. But compassion is a bigger picture. With compassion, we might actually help the person who's eating meat to stop eating meat. But if we go straight against them, because you're bad, you're eating meat, the likelihood is it won't be effective. Trust is often very effective. It helps us to listen to somebody. It helps us to allow that person to be the way they are. Now let's look and see if things can change. Accepting a person as they are, and then trying to heal. So trust is that process, rather than having to fight everyone and control everybody. It's interesting that the Buddha he was a meat eater, and the reason is that the Buddha and the monks at his time, what was important to them was to accept everything that came into the bowl. So they went around the villages with a bowl, and they got all the leftovers from the households. They were like beggars. And it was important to them to have what was thrown out from houses that people left over from their meals. Important for them to do that and not to choose what's in my bowl. No, I don't. Can I have that one? That looks more tasty. Thank you. It's funny, Ajahn Amaro, when he was here, was saying how our mind is like one of those bowls. Whatever comes in, that's what we have. Whatever's thrown out, whatever's thrown at us, we have to just digest it. The Tibetan image of the Bodhisattva is an archetypal image of equanimity. The bodhisattva is defined. The definition of the bodhisattva is someone that has developed a high level of awareness, is supremely equanimous and hugely compassionate, and then goes out in the world and makes change because of not having bali lo bali, tovli lo tovli, but just having a stream of equanimity and helping everybody, never mind who, and compassion to everybody, never mind who. Image came to mind of Nelson Mandela. There's something about him after 25 years of retreat in prison in South Africa. Really something happened there, because there's something really equanimous about him. And the presence, anyway, I don't know what's going on inside. Maybe he's full of storms, but he's got a quality of equanimity that he brought and made a change to the whole country. And I believe it's the equanimity that he showed, the sense of equality, the sense that he didn't attack the whites and didn't just... He was able to make peace where others could not. I wish we had some more equanimity in this part of the world. So it's a really good basis for action. Trust instead of fighting conditions and trying to change everything and trying to control things and having preferences. I remember there was one day many years ago, we did a peace walk in Jerusalem. The peace walks we did then were slow, silent walks. Jews, Arabs, walking together through cities, towns, countryside, all over Israel. We did many, 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 sometimes hundreds of people. And at this particular evening, we were walking in Jerusalem, walking a line, steady and quiet, really embodying peace and steadiness. That was the message. Peace is possible. And here, look at us, we are expressing peace, Jews and Arabs together. So we were walking through Jerusalem, and then we came past some kikar where there was a political meeting. And it was people, in a way, on the same side, or it was Peace Now, Shalom Akshav meeting. But it was noisy, so much shouting and arguing and shouting and from the microphones, very loud and so on. And we were walking next to them. And it was quite funny just to see the two worlds. I don't say one is better, one is... I'm not saying that judging anything. But that I never forgot the two worlds here of how they met together for one few minutes and then we went our way. And... there was something in our language which was equanimous, which was trusting, which was saying, look, we're doing it, rather than shouting for it. So another of the questions that I brought up, how can equanimity help us to make choices in life? And surely making choices needs a lot of decisions, it needs us to know what we want, it needs us to have preferences again. Will equanimity make us completely wobbly? Just wobbly, I don't know how the word, not Ned. Like Daisa. Equanimity porridge. Oh, that's a nice sign. Someone, the cooks, can you make equanimity porridge tomorrow? but actually, it can make Equanimity can make choices easier, not harder. And it's the reason is that we're more open like the sky. There's more space inside. There's more awareness. And there's more steadiness. And what happens then is that that steady, spacious place is instead of the inner dialogue that says, what's good for me? What's better? What's not better? What's better? What's not better? This is better or this is better? Shall I get married? Shall I not get married? Shall I get divorced? Shall I not get divorced? Shall I go to university? Shall I not? Months and months and months of intense conceptual trying to find out the best. So painful sometimes. And months of indecision. And it's because the self can't do that. The self can't tell you what's going to happen. So the best we can do is kind of think like crazy, trying to work out the best thing for me, and we fail. And in the end, the decision is anyway taken in 1 second because we're exhausted. Instead of that, if we're coming from a place which is more open and more wise, I mentioned the word sattva right at the beginning, that is more subtle, more clear, more wise, and less full of what's good for me, what's bad for me, better for me, not better for me, but a big picture, we're more likely to be able to make choices quickly, easily, from intuition and wisdom and a sense of rightness. A difficult thing to describe, a sense, this feels right. And that can take just a second. That feels right. Why? I don't know. But it's coming from a place of more wisdom, more awareness, and more equanimity. Not full of me and what is better, what is not better. So sometimes in that place, choices can be much easier and immediate. There's an old poem written, 100 years ago, English poet, who said, the leaf falls from the tree. The west wind blows. And the leaf said, I think I'll go east now. And then the east wind blows. And the leaf says, well, I think I'll go west now. And then the wind stops. And the leaf says, ah, I can fall straight to the ground. Very sweet. So, how do we go out in the world and make change? How can equanimity help us? Or does it stop us? Like the story of Nelson Mandela. If we can imagine, maybe some of the images that you heard today from Ron, if we can imagine that being equanimous and steady is like being a big ship. It's like being a steady ship that's not rocked by every wave. Being steady, it has power. There is power in it. Our point of view is bigger. From a point of view that's bigger, the point of view of the earth and the sky, we go out in the world and we can make change. Because we have a bigger point of view. So we get opposition, resistance from the world. It doesn't knock us down. We're not destroyed. It didn't work, it does work. It doesn't undo. We keep going because of equanimity. It works, it doesn't work. That's not in our hands. We trust that what we're doing is needed and we let go. That needs equanimity. Otherwise, we're constantly measuring. We did it, we didn't do it. Success and failure. So much stress in organizations, companies, you know, all the time stress based on success, failure. It worked, didn't work, it worked, didn't work. Equanimity undoes the blocks to action. For example, classic blocks. Think about people working in ecology, climate change. So easy. We just had in CLIL, I was just teaching a weekend for activists of working in climate change. And a lot of the work was about dealing with views that block action, like, oh, it's hopeless, or despair. It's not going, nothing I can do will make a difference. The world is really collapsing. Or frustration, no one's listening, everyone's going crazy, nothing I can do. All the sorts of views and blocks. And equanimity undoes those blocks. They're not interested in blocks, just goes out and does what is needed. With a big view. We offer ourselves to the world and we let go of results. We offer ourselves because there's nothing much else to do. What are we going to do? How many pizzas can we eat? What are we going to do with our life? So anyway, we go out and help others. So it also helps to develop compassion, because when we are equanimous, compassion arises in the heart. The equanimous heart, or the open heart, or the sky-like vision perspective, rather than the me perspective, the open perspective creates compassion. Compassion is hearing the cry of pain, listening to the difficulty, receiving the difficulty, knowing it, but having a big enough, wide enough heart that we're not destroyed by it. So compassion is a beautiful way of acting in the world, and it needs that bigger vision. So finally, final point, going out in the world and making change in our life, in the life of people, and it doesn't matter where, in politics, in ecology, in anything we do, working with others, working with helping in any way, it's full of small actions. We need to allow that. Small actions, spontaneous small actions in the present moment. That's all we really can do. And it's if our point of view is there, like a big open point of view, and we do small actions that are needed. The two together. It's like the ecological phrase, think globally, act locally. Or the Tibetan phrase, keep your vision as wide as the sky, but sieve, mesanen, sieve your actions like fine flour. You keep your vision as wide as the sky, but watch your small actions. So that's it, really. That's all you can do. That's the best you can do, and it's a lot. And what it means is that instead of preferences, expectations, my need to change the world, my view of the way things should be. Instead of all of that, we move to another place where trust is one of those. We move to a place of qualities, where we are building qualities, and this is how we help the world. So we build inner qualities and express them in the world. Instead of saying, I need me, I have to change that, we say, what qualities can I bring into the world? And that's a whole different dialogue. And that's basically stress-free. And also not about success and failure. And it's sustainable. So many people in the world of activism just get burnt out from exhaustion and struggle. But if you're saying, I'm manifesting qualities in the world, then your whole life is like that, and that's fine. And qualities, these are what we're talking about. Trust, steadiness and equanimity, joy and ease, quietness and awareness. Qualities we bring into the world. That's what we're doing. And that makes change without pressure. So it moves the whole, in a way, the motive, the motivation for action to another place. Instead of, I'm motivated to action because I see Eid Tzedek and I want to fix the world, we are developing and expressing qualities, and we hope that that will heal Eid Tzedek that we see, or anything else. So it's a different place. It's coming from the inside out. And that's the importance of qualities like equanimity and trust. And we radiate them into the world. Okay, thank you. Let's take a couple of minutes quiet.